Trump makes his case, Democrats have a new face, and the Correspondents' Dinner podium will have an empty place. It's another Oscar-winning performance on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. President Trump lays out his agenda before lawmakers, and he sounds, well, presidential. Are we seeing a new Trump?
What we saw was Donald Trump demonstrating that he can act presidential. Now we need to see whether or not he can actually carry out the duties of the office in a fashion that reminds us more of past presidents.
Plus, the Democrats now have a new national chair, but they have a long way to go to catch up with the GOP.
I was heartbroken on November the 8th, but I am energized and excited and enthused with the Democratic excitement that we are seeing across the Commonwealth. I mean, everywhere.
And was that the former vice president we saw on the campaign trail in Delaware?
Joe Biden is the most beloved man in the state. Nobody knows how to get Delaware Democrats fired up. It was really cool watching this sort of legendary Delaware figure out on the stump.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 168 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. We saw a seemingly new Donald Trump as he addressed Congress Tuesday night, sounding much more presidential without his customary attacks on the media and their fake news. How long this rendering will last is anyone's guess, but it's hard to see him staying away for long from the kind of beat-the-press pronouncements we heard at CPAC last weekend.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake. A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people.
Assailing the liberal media has been a popular theme for as long as there's been a CPAC. But the lying media, the fake media, the enemy of the people media, that's new. That's vintage Trump. And it's popular with his base, but not everyone thinks it's a smart strategy, including former President George W. Bush. He was interviewed this week on the Today Show by Matt Lauer.
Even at the times where you were dealing with the worst criticism, where it must have been very difficult to hear and read some of the things that were being said by the press in this country, did you ever consider the media to be the enemy of the American people?
I consider the media to be indispensable to democracy, that we need an independent media to hold people like me to account. I mean, power can be very addictive, and it can be corrosive, and it's important for the media to call to account people who abuse their power.
We learned a lot of things over the past few days. At the Oscars, especially at the end, we learned about grace and dignity. And from the president, we learned this about health care.
Now, I have to tell you, it's an unbelievably complex subject. Nobody knew that health care could be so complicated.
Exactly. Nobody knew. Anyway, that mention of the Academy Awards leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last Oscar nominee for Best Actor or Best Actress to play an American politician who did not die while in office? Let me repeat that. The last Oscar nominee for Best Actor or Best Actress to play an American politician who didn't die while in office. Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
I want to grow up to be a politician and take over this beautiful land. I want to grow up to be a politician and be the old U.S. of A's number one man. I'll always be tough, but I'll never be scary. I want to shoot guns or butter my bread. I'll work in the towns or cultivate the prairies. days ahead.
President Trump's address to a joint session of Congress Tuesday evening was notable for several things, none more so than the tone he set. It was measured, lacking in vitriol, filled with calls for unity and compromise. To discuss this speech, both insofar as his words and his tone, we're joined by Stuart Harnish, an 83-year-old associate professor in semantics at Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey. He's been covering presidential language since the Coolidge administration, and he will... Oh my God. I was given the wrong envelope. My guest is not Stuart Harnish. I apologize. It's Ron Elving, that guy from NPR. I don't know how that happened. Ron, it's great. I'm so sorry, but it's great having you back on the show.
You know, Ken, this is the first time I have ever confused you with Warren Beatty.
I love that novel. Wasn't that Tolstoy?
It was.
Warren Beatty?
Warren Beatty, yeah. Warren Beatty. On the other hand, as time goes on, I find that more and more people confuse me with Faye Dunaway.
You know something? Well, you know something? Everybody talks about Russian involvement. Did you know, and I'm not making this up, Faye Dunaway has the same number of letters as Leon Trotsky? I'm not kidding. I spent hours figuring that out.
I think that's why everyone switched to email.
That could be one reason. Anyway, so I'm sorry about the confusion, and I'll be honest with you, I made up the name Stuart Harnish. There was no such person because there's no such thing as Fairleigh Dickinson University. But anyway...
But you should have said you were going to interview Fairleigh Dickinson.
It wasn't Fairleigh Dickinson. It was kind of Dickinson, I thought.
Uh-huh.
In some ways, it was very Dickinson.
Approximately Dickinson.
Listen...
This is why we've always been so well known for getting right down to the subject right away.
Well, my producer just learned the meaning of the word head desk because he's pounding his head against the desk as we're doing this. But anyway, I think it's clear that we need to start with the news of the week, and it could be best summed up in three words.
Come on. La La Land.
Okay, I had to lead with that because, Ron Elving, did you ever...
No, I never. And the weird thing is the number of people who, as soon as Faye Dunaway said that, flipped off their television, either because it confirmed what they expected or because they were disgusted having preferred one of the other eight films. And a lot of the people who preferred Moonlight, I think, in particular, felt that way. But, you know, the show had gone on a long time. If you have the misfortune of not living in Los Angeles or the West Coast, you know, it gets late back here in the East. And so folks were ready for it to be over.
Yeah, I'm not saying it went on a long time, but I think Jack Parr started the show.
Johnny Carson used to do it, and before that there was Bob Hope, and before that there was Jack Benny.
That's right. I remember Johnny Carson would always make fun about how late it would run, and of course it ran pretty late. But you know something? When I was thinking, I love movies as I know you do, but I also love to see the political overtones in an event like that. And I thought it wasn't as anti-Trump as I expected it to be.
It was anti-Trump, but it wasn't over the top.
Yeah, I was thinking, I mean, last year it was Oscars So White and Black Lives Matter. This year on Sunday night, it was more like Burl Ives Mattered.
It was a little tamer than I expected. Jimmy Kimmel had his fun, but he was not really any more over the top than Jimmy Fallon had been at the Golden Globes Awards with the Trump jokes.
No, I agree. Well, anyway, speaking of La La Land, and we'll get to the Trump address to Congress in a few minutes, but sum up the first 5 weeks of the Trump presidency.
You know, I prefer actually a biblical time frame of 40 days and 40 nights.
You're right.
Which is also available. This was a remarkable night because it was so different from the first weeks of the Trump administration. The leading term, I would say, the leading candidate to be the noun for the first weeks was chaos, because you had so much disagreement among different people who were powerful in the White House, and you had the clear sense that Trump himself had really not devoted a tremendous amount of time to thinking about exactly what he was going to do. Once he actually got in the Oval Office, he had a general idea. He had a overarching plan. He wanted to make America great again, and he had his animus against trade and some aspects of immigration, some attitudes towards business, and some attitudes towards Democrats. But he did not really have a program in the usual sense that most presidents have had before they came to office. So all the people underneath him were constantly contesting to see who could set that agenda. And that showed.
Yes, I agree completely, but then comes Tuesday night when, you know, Donald Trump walks down that House aisle up to the podium. And, you know, in the past 5 weeks or a little past year and a half, he couldn't get through his speech without talking about the corrupt press or the dishonest press and fake news. But nary a word of that Tuesday night.
There was one sort of drive-by shooting when he said that the media were not reporting on the degree of violence that there had been and the killings that there had been by illegal immigrants or by people who had crossed the border illegally. He said that he had to have this new agency, this new office, to give voice, as he calls it, to those crimes. And, of course, he had in the gallery of the initial six guests that were going to sit with the First Lady, half of them were people who had had family members killed by people in the country illegally. So this was a heavy emphasis, and he was saying quite explicitly the media had never reported on any of this, which is really truly strange credulity, because we do report on those things, and we report on them quite a lot and quite often and extensively whenever they do happen. But in fact, people in the country illegally do not commit crimes at a higher rate than people who lived here all their lives or were born here. In fact, probably at a somewhat lower rate by most studies. It's a little bit hard to get a grip on those numbers. But apart from that, you're right. The president did let it go with respect to, you know, the lying New York Times and all the rest of it. He's been particularly brutal about your podcast, Ken.
Yeah. Well, I thought he went too far. Although at the Oscars, when the awards were for the best picture, and he made a change in the script, instead of the movie Lion, he called Lion Media, and I thought that was a little too far. Once again, my producer is shaking his head. Ron, you have a lot of influence. Can you do something about this?
I can't stop his head from shaking. It comes from banging it against the desk so much.
Yeah, I guess so. You know something also, he had a press conference a week or so ago, which I thought was very interesting, when somebody stood up and a reporter stood up and talked about all the anti-Semitic acts of violence going around the country. And Trump's very curious answer, I thought, was that he's the least anti-Semitic person in the world. And then he also said he's the least racist person in the world. And people would roll their eyes, if not criticize him, for not being aggressive about it. And then he leads off his address Tuesday night talking about bigotry and tolerance. Let me play that tape.
Tonight, as we mark the conclusion of our celebration of Black History Month, we are reminded of our nation's path toward civil rights and the work that still remains to be done. Recent threats targeting Jewish community centers and vandalism of Jewish cemeteries, as well as last week's shooting in Kansas City, remind us that while we may be a nation divided on policies, we are a country that stands united in condemning hate and evil in all of its very ugly forms.
I would be generous in talking about that and say that the president took exactly the right moment to say exactly the right things about some of the awful things that are taking place in the country. One can then say, gee, it took a long time before he did, and he certainly seemed to have saved that up over recent days and weeks. And if you can, you know, go another step to being really cynical, you could say that he put it at the top of this speech and hadn't talked about it until this time, so as to have a line that all the people in that hall for the House of Representatives, the great chamber of the House, would have to stand up and applaud. Now, I'm not that cynical, but I suspect that there are people in the world who will take that view of it.
There are also people who, you know, there are also people, including the president himself, who said, don't take me for what I say, take me for what I do. And it's one thing to have lofty rhetoric at an address to Congress. It's another to follow up on it. So I just thought it was, you know, I agree with you. I don't like to be cynical. I don't want to be cynical about it. I don't want to say, well, it was in response to all the critics he had. And since when does Trump respond to critics anyway? But it just seemed like, to start the speech, I'm just wondering if it was, well, one, I didn't object to anything he said. I think he said hit all the right notes. But it just felt like, okay, let me get this out of the way, and I don't have to mention this ever again.
It did have that effect in practical sense, because then he could move on. And, you know, with respect to the overall watch what we do, not what we say, that we have heard oftentimes from Trump folks, and of course it's a line that goes back to an official in the Nixon administration, as you know, Ken. But Let's just say that Steve Bannon, who is the eminence gris, the gray eminence behind Donald Trump in a lot of the things that he has been doing and saying, including the inauguration speech, he could still smile last night knowing that even if Ivanka Trump and her husband Jared Kushner had a lot to do with this particular speech to Congress, that when everybody got up on Wednesday morning and Thursday morning and Friday morning, they were going to go right back to work on an agenda that is very much more that of Steve Bannon.
Yeah, I agree. No, I agree. And speaking of Nixon, I mean, I wasn't old enough to be on Nixon's enemies list, but I was on his Franz list, which I thought was a very honorable. I was very proud of that. Listen, I'm not sure that the Democrats were buying everything they heard in Trump's speech, but in this soundbite I want to play, you could actually hear them laughing at the president. Listen to this.
We have begun to drain the swamp of government corruption by imposing a five-year ban on lobbying by executive branch officials.
I mean, it wasn't exactly Joe Wilson yelling, "You lie," but it sure expressed a skepticism, I think, of many Democrats.
Yes, and we have heard people laugh in the front row of State of the Union speeches and presidential addresses before. It's always been disapproved of. It's always been bad behavior, and it was bad behavior again last night. But if you were going to choose a moment at which to spontaneously be unable to stifle a laugh, it would probably be the point at which Donald Trump talks about draining the swamp and getting rid of corruption in Washington.
You know, he often says the same exact things to different audiences. They talk about the crooked press. Obama left me a mess to clean up, round them up and send them home. I had this record margin of victory. I mean, we heard none of that on Tuesday, but we heard no specifics either. Although I guess this is not the kind of speech that usually involves specifics.
It can or maybe not. I mean, this being his very first speech to Congress, it could still be an extension, if you will, of the inauguration address. And that's why they don't call it a State of the Union when somebody hasn't really been in power for very long. On the other hand, we have seen people like Ronald Reagan, whose first speech to Congress was delayed because, among other reasons, he got shot in the first few months of his presidency. And we've seen people like Ronald Reagan, who, by the way, gave the longest first address to Congress other than Donald Trump's in recent history. And Donald Trump went on for, I believe, 72 minutes on Tuesday night. Reagan had given a slightly longer speech in 1981. But in doing that speech, Reagan was laying out his entire program for changing the spending priorities of the federal government, increasing spending on defense and how he wanted to do it, and changing the tax code. It was really quite a programmatic speech. And that is not really where Donald Trump was prepared to go.
Yeah, I was going to say, he mentioned repeal and replace, but there were no details. Yes, we'll build a wall, but there was nothing about deportations, not a word about that. A record budget for defense, but all those reports we saw about big cuts in the State Department and the EPA and food stamps, there was none of that.
No, and he says he's going to increase the budget of the Defense Department by $54 billion, a lot of money, no doubt, but that's about a 10% kind of increase, and it really would only cover for what they've lost in terms of material and capability in the last 15 years of kind of constant warfare. It would not begin to address some of the things he was talking about, rebuilding the Navy and things of that nature.
What did you think was the most memorable moment of the night?
Well, without question, the most memorable moment of the night was the introduction of the widow of William Ryan Owens, who was the Navy SEAL who was killed in the one military operation that Donald Trump has already authorized, that we know of. And that was a somewhat disappointing mission. We're not clear how abortive it really was, but apparently they were going after some kind of a target that was not achieved. Something like 30 civilians, including quite a few children, were killed. And this one American Navy SEAL was killed, and his widow was there in the gallery last night sitting with Donald Trump's family. And she was weeping and very dramatically stood up and acknowledged an extensive standing ovation by everyone in the House chamber. Went on for minutes. So much so that it really was a moving moment, no matter how you feel about any of the circumstances around this mission or this death or the objections that the father of William Ryan Owens has raised to what happened to his son. No matter how much or how little you know about the case, you had to be moved by the sight of this woman.
Let me talk a little bit about the tone of the president. He talked a lot about compromise and working together. Let me play an excerpt.
I just want to say, you know, Can we all get along? Can we get along? Can we stop making it horrible for the older people and the kids?
That was an emotional moment, I thought, Ron.
It was, and you know, the president has actually gotten a lot of attention over the years for his extraordinary impression of Rodney King in Los Angeles in 1992.
Yeah, no, I should not be doing Rodney King jokes, especially all these years later. But look, there was no sign of the Trump combativeness. But is it wrong? I don't know exactly what I'm trying to ask you here. Is it naive to be focusing on his tone, or should we be instead waiting for to see his next tweet or his next executive order? In other words, what I'm trying to say is, should we take what we were offered Tuesday night and appreciate it, or should we just wait for the next insult to drop, or am I being too cynical here?
What we saw on Tuesday night was Donald Trump demonstrating that he can act presidential. Now we need to see whether or not he can actually carry out the duties of the office in a fashion that reminds us more of past presidents. Up to now, the reason we're all focused on the tone and the mood and the behavior is because it has been so unusual, so unprecedented, the anger of it, the personalness of it, the fascination with the size of his crowds, the fascination with his reception in the news media, the personal rivalries and sort of petty way that he goes after his adversaries. That was all absent on Tuesday night, and I would say it was welcome in its absence to most Americans. But for the angry minority, who are the hardest core of his base, they aren't going to lose any of their affection for Donald Trump. This one night will not mean anything particularly negative to them. In fact, they seem to be quite pleased with it. So the president added something to his base of support, and I'm sure his approval numbers, which have not been very good, which have been historically low, are going to improve, at least temporarily, until, as you say, we see where he goes from here.
Let me say one last thing about the Democratic response. I thought Steve Beshear's response was pretty good, but there was not enough coverage, I thought, and the sacrifice that Elliot Engel made. Elliot Engel is the congressman from the Bronx. He said he was so angry at Trump that he gave up his aisle seat in the House chamber. Think of Frederick Douglass, think of Rosa Parks, but now Elliot Engel is up with them. Sacrifice.
Not only did he sacrifice his seat on the aisle, but he got back an entire day that he usually spends by sitting in that seat so as to mark it out and keep it from anyone else who might want to sit there for a period of several hours before the president arrives, so that he will have this privileged position and always be seen shaking hands with the president.
You know that everybody says that the Democrats don't stand up for principles. I thought Elliot Engel really took it up a notch, at least on Tuesday night.
He stepped it up. But you know, it's the New Yorkers who know him best.
That's true. Ron Elving is a senior editor and correspondent for NPR. For many years, when I would do the It's All Politics podcast at NPR, he was the other guy.
I was the other guy.
Whatever happened to him?
I have no idea.
Ron, it's great having you and being with you and sharing you with the American public.
And Ken, as you know, there is nothing I enjoy more than sharing the American public with you.
Thanks, Ron. I have to get off the phone. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Be in my broadcast when this is over. Give me your shoulder. I need a place to wait for morning. No, it was nothing. Some car backfiring. Please don't ask questions. I hate your lover. Let me sleep.
People never read the airwaves. Do we only feed the airwaves?
Democrats elected a new national chair on Saturday. Former Obama Labor Secretary Tom Perez narrowly defeated Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison on the second ballot. For all its alleged symbolism, was it really a battle of surrogates, the establishment versus the progressives? Here's one thing we do know. The Democrats, with big losses in 2016, have a long way to go to get back into the game. One state that was hard-fought last year was Virginia. It was a rare note of good news for the party in the South. Hillary Clinton, with Senator Tim Kaine as her running mate, won the Old Dominion by about 5 percentage points. And the Commonwealth will be in the spotlight in 2017 as well, holding one of only two gubernatorial contests up this year. Susan Swecker is the Democratic State Chair of Virginia and joins us to talk about her state and the state of her party. She's joining us by Skype. Susan, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me. Nice to hear from you.
Democrats have carried Virginia in the presidential election three times in a row, but until Barack Obama in 2008, Democrats had lost 10 times in a row. So where would you place the Commonwealth politically right now? Is it blue? Is it purple? Is it orange? What is it?
Well, I would have to say it's purple. I mean, we are very excited to carry, particularly this year, being the only southern state to carry for Hillary Clinton. But in the end, we still, you know, the House of Delegates is still 2-1 Republican. The Senate, state Senate, is Republican, albeit just barely. So I think you still have to say we're a purple state. All the demographics are very much in our favor. I don't take anything for granted. Although I want to talk about just a little bit, too, that wasn't just carrying a state for Hillary and Tim wasn't our only victory. We're very proud. And you and I have been friends a long time, known each other a long time. You've seen this shift. But who would have ever thought that we would defeat a right to work amendment in the Commonwealth of Virginia, working hand in hand with labor, and spent very little money on that, a partnership, and we defeated that. And again, here, City of Richmond, capital of the Confederacy, where a young African American, 35 years old, won the mayoral election, and really a big changing of the guard, and picked up a congressional seat. Donald McEachin won a congressional seat for us. So we had really four big victories on election night.
Tell me, what did Virginia know that every other state in the South didn't know?
We worked really hard. I think some of it is, you know, changing demographics. I do think that North Carolina and Georgia aren't far behind us. I can't speak for the differences of what they did. I do know that having a governor who was very close to Hillary Clinton, who stayed on top of things, probably helped us as well. But the changing urban crescent and demographics also gave us, I think, an edge. And honestly, we left no stone unturned. We fought for every vote. I'm from the western part of the state. I and others spent a whole lot of time out there because the way I look at it, a vote is a vote. Doesn't matter where it comes from.
You know, we always, especially, I mean, the election year after a presidential year, there's always outsized influence of an interpretation of states like Virginia and New Jersey, the two states having gubernatorial races this year. But obviously everything is magnified, especially in the era of Donald Trump. What role do you think that Virginia plays in the Democrats' hopes for getting back into the game?
We've always had that sort of curse of the opposite party winning. Whoever won the presidency, the opposite party would win the governor's race in Virginia.
That was always true until last time, right?
Until Terry McAuliffe broke the curse. And I think that there's a lot of things that have changed. And I do think all eyes are on Virginia next year. And I think, you know, who knows? I mean, I will say this, like after November 8th, I don't think I know anything anymore. So I'm just going to get up every morning and work really hard for the Democrats and hold Donald Trump's feet to his fire. You know, I certainly hope he keeps these promises to a lot of people, particularly the folks where I came from, you know, who are hurting and voted for him in hopes that, you know, he would, you know, give them some relief and answers. But, you know, I'm going to wake up every day and hold him accountable. And if he helps them, I'll say, great, Mr. President, thank you. And if he doesn't, you know, I'm going to hold his feet to the fire on that and say, where's your plan? What are you doing for him? Why aren't you helping those miners? Why aren't you, you know, getting behind Tim Kaine and Mark Warner and Joe Manchin and Shelley Caputo and the plan that they have to, you know, help them? You know, there's a part of ACA that, you know, would in the pre-existing condition piece would gut the, you know, black lung benefits. What's your plan for that? Where is it?
Last weekend's race for Democratic National Committee chair, what did you make of it? And what do you say to those who said, well, this was really a battle of surrogates between, you know, the Bernie Sanders and the Elizabeth Warren wing and the Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton wing, the one that was ultimately won by Tom Perez?
Yeah, well, first of all, I've got to tell you, I brought some chum for you here, if you can see. We got lots of buttons.
Ooh, she's holding up buttons. I'd love when people hold up buttons on a radio. Ooh, I like this.
I'm going to send you some things here, and I got a little Mardi Gras beads from Karen Carter Peterson. And I do have to throw this out. I don't know if you can see it, because Bob Mulholland, who's on the DNC from California, you might remember him, even brought by something from the past, Terry McAuliffe for DNC chair shirt.
Oh, my goodness.
He pulled that out.
I love Skype. I love Skype.
Isn't that great? Isn't that great?
Let me just interrupt for a second. You know, I mean, those of us with long memories, I remember when Nancy Pelosi, before she was in Congress, ran for DNC chair. Terry Sanford ran for DNC chair. A lot of these races in the past for Democratic National Committee chairperson were really big league, big time, bigly, as somebody would say.
Bigly.
Exactly. Kind of campaigns. And I love seeing those names from the past.
Yeah. So I would say about that, I think that a lot of that was a creation of the media, the proxy war thing. I thought that, look, I'm not even sure anybody cared so much about what anyone in establishment ranks said. I was very proud of all of our candidates that were running. And I mean, I think we had some really great rising stars. Mayor Pete, I thought he was very interesting.
From South Bend, Indiana.
Yeah, he was very inspiring. We had Jason Kander speak. He was great. Jason Carter spoke. There's a lot of, I wish there'd been more women actually speak. I mean, we're a little short on that. But I thought that everybody was rowing in the same direction. And I really appreciated the fact that, I mean, it was a close race that went to second ballot. I thought that was good, that everybody had a chance to have their say. Keith went to immediately endorse Tom, and then Tom said, I want to make Keith a deputy. I mean, it was very, if you were there, it was very united. And I think everybody in the room understood what the stakes are, you know, where we are as a party and the position we are in. And so I felt came out of there, albeit incredibly tired and weary, feeling really good about our party and what we did in terms of letting, I mean, the transparency of the 2-month process and having the forums all across the country, everybody having a say and input. I thought that Donna Brazil did an incredibly great job of that, and that we ended up being very united. And I was proud. I was proud of all of our candidates.
Susan, here's a question, though. What can a DNC chair, what could Tom Perez do to help the party?
Well, first of all, and you've known this too. I mean, it's a different party when you don't have the presidency or either in the bodies of Congress, really like when Terry McAuliffe had it or sometimes when Howard Dean had it. It's a very different party when you don't have particularly the presidency as when you do. When you have the presidency, that's your titular head of the party, and he or she, fortunately, unfortunately, I have a she, you know, they control a lot of the decisions. But when you are, you know, Tom Perez is really now our leader. That is it. You are the one. And so you set the tone. You work with the leaders that we have in Congress and other stakeholders. And you have to herd all those cats and try to make sure that everybody is on one page. And, you know, you set the tone, you help set the message, you get everybody hopefully to play nice together. I mean, we're counting on him a lot. We're counting on his help, his support, his guidance for our governor's race and our down ballots this year. I mean, all eyes really are on us in New Jersey, but I mean, I think, you know, all eyes are on us. So that's, we want him to be a full partner with us.
Well, governors can't succeed themselves in Virginia. So Terry McAuliffe is obviously retiring. What is his future?
Well, he's been a great governor, and I think what he is focused on right now, and he's made very clear, is that he wants to, finish out strong He's focused totally on, he's been a great governor, by the way. I mean, you know, and he laughs. He's like, whoever would think, you know, I'd be governor living here. But he has been a really great governor and a really solid economics jobs governor. Republicans have tried to just thwart him every step of the way. And he has gotten up every morning working hard for Virginians. And so I think he wants to focus on that now, finish strong, help elect the next Democrat. We have two running for, but he's very much wants to see a Democrat succeed him. And then I think he'll decide, but you know, Terry, there's a lot of energy there in him. I don't think he's done yet.
And Tim Kaine, I mean, he came out of 2016, I think pretty much unscathed. What's in his future?
Well, he's made it clear the Senate is his life and he's gearing up to run for reelection. I will say we were really proud of him. And really proud of his wife, who's a friend, good friend of mine, Ann Holton, who's, you know, got her own pedigree resume in her.
Linwood Holton's daughter.
Yeah, Linwood Holton's daughter and Secretary of Education for Governor McAuliffe till she resigned to go on the campaign trail. I mean, what a great, they're such a great team.
You have the House of Delegates up, and as you pointed out, the Republicans have basically a 2-1 lead among delegates in Virginia. What's your prediction as far as how the Democrats will do in those races?
Yeah, I say the Republicans need to watch out. We're being very aggressive. We work very hand in hand with the House caucus here. We are fielding candidates in every district that Hillary Clinton won and more. We are being because look. Here's the one thing I was heartbroken on November the 8th, but I am energized and excited and enthused with the Democratic excitement that we are seeing across the Commonwealth. I mean, everywhere with people turning out they want to run for office. Our committees are overflowing with attendance and people wanting to join. So we are ready to go.
Susan Swecker is the Democratic State Chair of Virginia. And truth be told, I've known her for nearly 30 years, back when she was the party's executive director, right? I think that's what?
That's exactly right. That's how we met, right.
Susan, it was great having you on the program.
It was great talking with you.
The last time Donald Trump and the White House Correspondents' Dinner got together, it didn't go so well for the New York billionaire. The year was 2011, around the time Trump was pushing his Obama birther stories and hinting about a run for president in 2012. That was enough material for that year's host, comedian Seth Meyers.
Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising since I just assumed he was running as a joke. Donald Trump often appears on Fox, which is ironic, because a fox often appears on Donald Trump's head.
And President Obama joined in the fun.
No one is happier, no one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter. Like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell? And where are Biggie and Tupac?
Trump hasn't attended the dinner since, and that trend will continue this year, even though he is president. He announced by Twitter, of course, that he will skip the event. Nobody knows more about the dinner than Patrick Gavin, a former Politico reporter. Gavin left journalism to produce a documentary film highly critical of the dinner. Entitled Nerd Prom, Inside Washington's Wildest Week, Gavin mocked the dinner and the pre-parties and the after-parties that accompanied it for their extravagance. Patrick, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Even before Donald Trump and his war on the press and his war on Hollywood, what was the essence of your criticism of the Correspondents' Dinner?
Well, my criticism was primarily about the level and the status that this dinner has sort of taken on in Washington's political and social culture. It is our Super Bowl. It is the biggest event all year. It gets the most attention. It's the biggest buzz around it. There's the most after parties. It's now not only the dinner, it's now about 5 or 6 days of over 24 parties. And it's become our signature event. And that, to me, was the real troubling part, was not even so much the dinner, which is fine. I mean, people are allowed to let their hair down and have a few drinks and tell jokes. It's more that, you know, this town is by design supposed to represent the will of the people and be civic-minded, and yet for our biggest moment every year to be what I think kind of everyone at this point views as this kind of cozy, celebrity-filled, alcohol-filled, party-filled moment that's really all about us, I think sends the wrong signal to Americans at a time when Washington's approval rating already is in the tanks.
And how have the journalists reacted to your criticism?
Well, the association that throws a dinner doesn't like me and doesn't like the film, although they've never raised a single, you know, factual problem with it. But, you know, I think journalists who are no longer a part of the association will kind of tell you in sort of private one-offs that the film strikes a lot of right notes. And I think people who aren't as sort of embedded in the White House press corps, I mean, the dinner, I'm not the first person to criticize the dinner. I certainly won't be the last. But it's no, at this point, it's really no secret that the dinner does raise some questions, that the association that throws the dinner has some questions that it needs to answer, and that the town in general needs to sort of take more seriously into account whether or not we want our big event every year to be this.
With all these objections that you've had and you've expressed it over the years, switching gears to Trump saying he wasn't going to attend, how did you react to that? Don't you think it would have been fun to see the president subject to all those jokes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it both would have made sense for him to go and also for him not to go. I mean, he likes a stage. He likes a performance. He can do well in those settings. You know, he likes being around celebrities and he loves poking fun of the media. So in that sense, it would absolutely make sense for him to go. On the other hand, not only would he not want to sit in, get ribbed for 3 hours by both the comedian and the White House Correspondents Association. But in addition, you know, this whole idea that the press is the opposition party and the enemy, I mean, these aren't just one-offs that Trump makes. I mean, this is part of a very calculated strategy by both Trump and his top advisor, Steve Bannon. I mean, this is part of how they ran in 2016 and how they plan on running again in 2020. So to then wine and dine with the people that you're calling the enemy in the opposition party certainly doesn't fit that larger political calculus. So in that sense, it absolutely makes sense for him to skip it.
And I always I always picture back to those pictures of Trump during the 2011 dinner when he sat stone-faced, basically, in reaction to both Seth Meyers and President Obama.
Yeah, that's right. And that moment's kind of gone on to almost like myth-like levels of interpretation that that's why he ran. He's denied that publicly, but you're right. I mean, the tape doesn't lie. He says he had a great time that night, but
yeah.
If you look at his face during when he's the brunt of these jokes, he did not seem very happy at all.
Like, I had a great time when I was at the dentist last week. He looked like he was at the dentist, didn't he?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, even if you don't like Trump, it is this incredible story if we sort of follow that storyline that here's this guy who's being ridiculed by the Washington establishment, and what, 4 years later, he's the president of the United States. So, I mean, he certainly got his revenge, that's for sure.
I noticed that even in advance of the president saying that he wouldn't attend the dinner, that Vanity Fair and The New Yorker canceled their annual parties, and there were also calls for journalists to boycott the dinner because of Trump. You know, I mean, we always talked about and we complained about the coziness between the media and the president that they're supposed to cover, but then, well, then for the journalists to boycott it because they don't like Trump, something sounded wrong with that to me anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I'm all in favor of the after parties and the pre-parties shutting down and donating the money to the scholarship. I think that's great. But let's be honest. I mean, Trump might be, when all said and done, a worse president towards the press than Obama. But Obama was the worst since ever, according to White House reporters. I mean, Susan Page from the USA Today called him more dangerous than any president in history. And Peter Baker talked about how he's the least transparent president in history. You know, every president, the trend is that they're going to get worse and worse and worse towards the press because they can get away with it. So when Obama was president, he was the worst. And, you know, Vanity Fair and Bloomberg and all these places weren't talking about shutting down those parties. And, you know, let's not beat around the bush just because Obama was liked by those people. But I think with Trump, it's more, I think, socially and, you know, in certain circles, politically acceptable to protest him, which is not to take away from, you know, the serious legitimate complaints about Trump's attitude towards the press. But yes, it did, at least to me, it rang a little bit hollow that all of a sudden they're getting up in arms when, you know, Obama prosecuted more whistleblowers than anybody in history and clamped down on freedom of information requests and, you know, went around the White House press corps routinely. So it was a little bit of selective outrage, I think.
I think the last president who missed a dinner was Reagan in 1981. And of course, he was recovering from an assassination attempt at that point. But and maybe Donald Trump is recovering from being laughed at in 2011. But you get a sense that for all of Trump's term in the White House, be it 4 years or 8 years, that President Trump may never show up at these things?
That's a great question. I mean, in an interview he's done since that news came out, he said that, you know, he was open to going again. If I had to guess, he'll probably sit out the first term, and if he wins the second term, maybe he will go. But, you know, there is something sad about it. It is one of Washington's, like, last remaining tradition that the president always goes. I mean, he doesn't go to the gridiron anymore. He doesn't go to the radio TV correspondents anymore. But, you know, this was sort of a must-do on his social calendar, and really is just, you know, one more example of the coarsening of relationships between the president and the press corps, which, you know, some people might argue is a great thing. But I think at the end of the day, if the president and the White House press corps can't sit down for 3 hours once a year, that's probably a net loss towards, you know, how business gets done in this town.
What do you think the future of the dinner is in the Trump era?
You know, I think it'll be fine. At this point, I mean, the dinner's been selling out since Clinton's first term. At this point, the dinner sort of has enough of a mythological status that it's going to continue to sell out. You know, if this becomes part of a larger trend, perhaps you could see attendance and tickets go down. I mean, as it is, we expected celebrity attendance to go down under Trump. But, you know, at this point, I think that the dinner has become enough of an institution under enough people who want to go, you know, in a somewhat small ballroom, that I think in terms of ticket sales, the dinner is going
to
be fine.
I just realized, I mean, it's one thing to say that Obama did prosecute many journalists during his 8 years as president, but he also had a good relationship with the celebrity and the celebrities who would attend this. You have Donald Trump waging war not only against the press, but against Hollywood as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think if celebrities come, they're probably going to come in the hopes of heckling the president, which is probably one more reason why Trump didn't want to show up. He just saw very little gain, I think, to subjecting himself to, at best, you know, a heavy slap on the wrist, and at worst, the total shellacking by all the folks in the room that really don't respect the way he disrespects the press.
Patrick Gavin is a former political reporter, now a documentary filmmaker, and a leading critic of what the Correspondents' Dinner has become. Patrick, thanks a lot for sharing your views with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, what president received the largest percentage of electoral votes? Okay, so maybe this wasn't the toughest question, but the answer is George Washington. In the elections of 1789 and again in 1792, Washington, the father of our country, the man named after that bridge in New Jersey, was the unanimous choice of all electors. And the randomly selected winner is Casey Rich of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Casey wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttlebutt winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. In our last contest, we led off with a button showing just the letter A. It's for anarchist. Then we once again violated the rules by offering up a Willie Mays baseball card, then a green button with the letters ING on it for Alaska Senator Ernest Greening, finally a button of the Jefferson Airplane lead singer Grace Slick. So when you combine A with Mays with Ing with Grace, you don't have to struggle too much to come up with Amazing Grace, the Christian hymn from the late 1700s. The winner is Robert Marlowe of Lavalette, New Jersey. As always, check out our website for our latest blog posts, scuttlebutt puzzles, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store. Go to krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see.
There was an interesting special election in Delaware on Saturday for a state Senate seat that became open when the incumbent was elected lieutenant governor. The vacancy created a tie in the chamber, but Delaware has become a blue state, and the Republicans hadn't controlled the Senate since the 1970s. So why did so many people focus on the race? Matthew Albright is a political reporter with the Wilmington News Journal and has been covering the contest, and he's on the program from Ireland, courtesy of Skype. Matthew, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you so much for having me, Ken. I appreciate it.
You sound like you're across the street or in the next room, but tell me what's going on in Ireland.
Well, all kind of great stuff. You know, for a political junkie, one of my favorite things about being in Ireland is learning about the very interesting political history here with figures like O'Connell and Mayer and all these folks who, just by sheer political genius, were able to make some pretty seismic changes in the state and in the political system here.
Well, you know, if you tell more people there about the political junkie, maybe our audience could be Dublin.
Yes, I'll do that. I'll make sure that everybody around here knows about this. Hey, you should listen to it.
That's right. Listen, Matthew, Republicans haven't carried Delaware in the presidential contest or the governorship or the Senate seat in nearly 30 years. I think 1988 was the same for all three. They're in the minority party in both the houses of the General Assembly. So I would have thought that Saturday's race would have been a ho-hummer, but there was a lot of attention paid to it, not only in Delaware, but all around the country. How come?
So during November, there were several Senate races that were up, and they were all Democrats, except for two who were in very safe Republican seats that won easily. And actually, there was a really surprising outcome where a total political newcomer, very young guy, Anthony Del Callo, unseated the president pro tempore of the Senate, so the ranking member of the Senate, who had been in the district for 20-something years. And there were a whole lot of reasons that that happened, but that not only meant that the Democrats had to pick a new tempore, they lost one of their seats. And then at the same time, another senator won the race for lieutenant governor, and so she had to vacate her seat. And you'll appreciate this little procedural move. The lieutenant governor wasn't inaugurated until the second week of the general session. So she took her current seat, because her seat was not up for re-election. She took her current seat and voted so that they could take all the procedural motions, like they could pick a Democratic pro tempore and leadership and all that kind of stuff. And then she was inaugurated.
So even though she was elected to another office, she held on to her state Senate seat so she could keep the Democrats in control.
Exactly, because with her, it was 11-10. But then as soon as she ascended to the lieutenant governor's office, her seat was vacated, and so it became 10-10. And the stakes of this became very clear when, for the first time that anybody in Delaware can remember, a governor's nominee was blocked. The governor nominated Sean Garvin to be Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources, basically Delaware's version, and he was blocked. The Republicans had enough votes. It was 10-10. The Democrats couldn't get the 11 votes they needed. And so right now we are with a sort of interim DENREC secretary. And that was sort of the illustration of the stakes.
You know, whenever you have a new president, but especially with somebody as controversial as Donald Trump, every new special election suddenly becomes, what does it mean for Trump? What does it mean for the anti-Trump forces? Did Donald Trump play any role at all in Saturday's election?
Absolutely. So special election turnout is generally low. It was not for this one, which I think we'll get to in a minute. But the goal, as most of your listeners who are probably pretty astute know, the goal in special elections where turnout is low is to fire up your base. And the candidate was very much out saying, and her supporters were very much saying, we're furious about Donald Trump winning. We didn't think this was going to happen. We're disgusted with everything he's done, like with the Muslim ban. These are people who stormed the airports when the Muslim ban happened. You know, they were participating in Delaware, northern Delaware. There was a women's march event up in Delaware. They were doing this. And I heard time and time again talking with these people saying, this is my first chance to strike back at the ballot box.
So tell me, who are the candidates, and tell me what were the issues involved in the race?
So the two candidates, well, there were actually three candidates. There was a libertarian, Joseph Lanzendorfer, but Delaware has really no history of third-party candidates getting much, and he was not really very competitive. He only won, like, less than 2% of the vote. But the Democrat was Stephanie Hansen, who's a sort of longtime political hand in Delaware and sort of local-level Delaware politics. She was Newcastle County. Delaware has three counties, and Newcastle County is the sort of liberal northern one. She was Newcastle County president in the 90s, I think. And she started as a community organizer, and she's been an environmental attorney, but she's been sort of part of the Democratic Party for a long time. She participated in elections going back years. The Republican was John Marino, who is a realtor and a retired New York police officer. And he had run twice in that district, which has a pretty significant Democratic advantage. And one of the reasons why the Republicans picked him is he had twice come within a couple of hundred votes. He'd won 49% of the vote twice in that district, once for the Senate district and one for the House district there. So they felt like he was competitive.
So he ran twice, came close twice, and he's running in the special election on Saturday, and it wasn't close.
Right. Yes. Now, what the Republicans will argue, of course it wasn't close. The Democrats spent at last count, more than $750,000, maybe $1 million, on a local Senate race, which in Delaware is just absurd, unheard of, colossal numbers.
Join the rest of the country.
Yes. Well, and what was really interesting about her fundraising was that money was pouring in from all over the country. I mean, I was actually just, you know, I have a Google alert for Delaware, and I saw a Mother Jones article pop up, and it was these people who were out fundraising in California for Stephanie Hansen. And they raised more than $100,000. I don't remember what the exact figure is, because they were basically saying, look, if we donate to a cause in California, we're pitting Democrat against Democrat. Our money doesn't really mean anything here. Let's find a way to donate to a race that matters. And this is one of the first races that has really big significance in a state since Trump won.
I was going to say, I mean, I noticed that some guy named Joe Biden got involved in the race, but also Martin O'Malley. I mean, the Democrats clearly wanted this.
Exactly. And I should point out that it wasn't just financial support that they got from all over the country. There were people, swarms of volunteers coming on. That campaign probably knocked on any door that was even remotely close, you know, because they have a pretty precise targeting operation. They probably knocked on every door in that district that had any chance of voting for them, probably several times. They just had this army of volunteers that were out knocking, placing signs, doing everything. But, I mean, the money does help, too. I mean, some residents of that district were telling me that they were getting a new glossy professional political flyer from either Stephanie Hansen or one of the PACs that was supporting her every single day in the weeks leading up.
And watching Joe Biden campaign again, I mean, I know, look, he's served 36 years in the Senate. He served 8 years as vice president. I suspect his active candidacy days are over, but he doesn't seem like he's going away anytime soon.
Joe Biden is the most beloved man in the state of Delaware, and it's not even close. I mean, if you've ever seen Joe Biden speak, whatever you think of his politics, he is a heck of a public speaker.
Oh, I think the first 4 hours of his speech are always the best part, I thought.
Oh, yeah, well, he shares a long tradition with some of the other top Delaware political figures and liking to talk for a long time. But nobody knows how to get Delawareans, particularly Delaware Democrats, fired up. And watching him stump for, I mean, you could see all over Facebook pictures of him in a jacket out on these crisp mornings out knocking on doors. And just imagine if you're a Delawarean and you open the door to a knock and there's Joe Biden standing out there. I actually had one Republican tell me sort of off the record. He was like, I honestly think Joe Biden is an even bigger weapon than, you know, $200,000 extra in campaign spending or something like that. It was really cool watching this sort of legendary Delaware figure out on the stump for an election that, you know, theoretically is a pretty small election. There's 62 seats in the General Assembly. This ain't the big leagues, but watching Joe out there both showed how important it was and was sort of, I think, for a lot of particularly Democrats, kind of nostalgic.
You know, he obviously he suffered some terrible losses, personal losses in the last year or so. But watching him on the campaign stump the last couple of days, he looked like he was enjoying himself tremendously.
He certainly at least is good at pretending that he's having the time of his life. And it seems genuine. You know, it's really fun to watch Joe Biden do politics.
Matthew Albright is a political reporter with the Wilmington News Journal. Matthew, thanks so much for interrupting your vacation in Ireland to talk about the special election in Delaware.
No problem. This was a blast. Thanks a lot.
I wish I was special. You're so very special. But I'm a creep.
Before we go, I want to thank everyone who's been writing in each day to compliment us on the music we play in every episode of The Political Junkie. It's really become a labor of love for us. Even those who don't always like the music write to us and talk about the stuff they'd like to hear. In fact, here, for some reason, was the listener's most requested song this week.
La, 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 la.
See, we can be topical with pop culture as well. Right. That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.